session number 28624, row 1.
Good morning. For the purpose of this interview, may I please have your name, please?
Certainly. It's Kinghorn, Roderick Kinghorn.
Okay. Your date of birth?
22nd of April, 1940.
Can you tell me where you were born, please?
Yes, Cairo in Egypt. My father was working in the Egyptian civil service. He went out after the First War. He went out then about 1921, and we came back as a family in 1952 when the king was deposed. And so I was 12 at the time, so I spent the first 12 years of my life in Cairo.
Can you give me a description of, like, the family background there, the type of house and things that you lived in?
In Cairo?
Yes.
Yes, I most certainly can, because I went back in April of this year, just a few months ago. So, not into the actual apartment. But Cairo, unless you were particularly wealthy, people lived in apartments rather than homes with lawns, as we know here. And our apartment was close to the Nile. Well, in fact, right beside the River Nile, so our balcony, which was a large one, overlooked the Nile. And it really was a second floor apartment, and it's now an office. And when I went back there, we actually dined below it, because the apartment of the people, Josie Hassan, as I remember her name, lived in the apartment below us, and that's now a very nice restaurant. We actually ate below our apartment, so that was a nice thing to do.
Okay. And what did your mother do out there?
Just looked after the home, so it was a nice style of life, of course, because you know, you would have servants. We had a servant, a cook, a washerwoman, an ironing man. So you know, she certainly didn't work. And life in Egypt in those days, just as in India, was built around a club life. We had a wonderful Gezira Sporting. The Gezira Sporting Club was on St. Malik, which is Gezira Island, and a beautiful place with all the facilities you could want: cricket pitches, football pitches, race course, golf course, swimming pools. And it was a club life. She would go to the club each day. My father was working for the Egyptian civil service, and he would then come to the club when he finished work at about 4. And when I wasn't at school, I was at the club.
Can you tell me something about your education as well, please?
Yes, certainly. I went to, in Egypt, it was normal to start at about the age of 4, and I went to a French convent, again on Gezira Island, very good convent where one had to speak French, because it was a French convent and they wouldn't allow you to talk English. So by the time I was 6, I spent 2 years there, and I was fluent French. I then went to the Gezira Preparatory School, which was English run, and there it was English run. All the embassy children used to be there, and in one class, I remember, had 28 nationalities in it. But no matter what your nationality, you were all made to sing Land of Our Birth and all the patriotic English songs. So there I was until I went at the age of 11 to the English school in Cairo, which was in Heliopolis, out in the suburbs of Cairo, and that was a secondary school and a very good one too. But only a year there before we had to come back. So when we came back to, well, I say come back, I'd never been here, but my father was an Aberdeenian, my mother came from Banff, so we came back to Aberdeen, where my father actually had a house, which was fortunate, because all his assets were frozen in Egypt and then looted by the new government of Egypt. So I finished off my education at Robert Gordon's College in Aberdeen.
And how did you feel about coming back to coming to Aberdeen then?
Well, I was very excited because I'd read so much about it and heard so much about it, but had never been here. So I was terribly excited and just loved it when I came here. Saw my first snow that very, within a week of arriving here. It was February we arrived, and saw snow for the first time. And just loved it, and loved Aberdeen, and loved school here.
I was about to say, did you enjoy school?
Yeah, loved it, yeah. Yeah, you know, there was a lot of sport going on, and I'm sports mad, so just terrific, yeah.
Okay. And can you remember some of the hobbies you had as a child?
No, I went through the usual ones, but didn't keep at them for very long. I suppose I was a stamp collector for about 3 months, and I think hobbies, not really. I was much involved in games, and you know, really full time at that. Hobbies, I can't say I remember any of those except stamps.
And when you say games, would that be more like rugby games and cricket?
Yeah, every game, yeah. Cricket, rugby, hockey, football, golf, just every sort of thing. Swimming, just anything that came along. Just an absolute all-rounder, yeah. Loved it.
And did the Robert Gordons fulfill the sporting side of life that you liked?
Yes, it did, yeah. In those days, sport was very important. I think, and certainly I hope it is just as important now, but the standard was very high, and yeah, that gave me the opportunity to either excel or just find a place in the second side. But it was a very sporty school.
Okay. And academically, how did you do academically?
Well, I suppose academically I suffered a little. You know, I mean, I did enough, and that's all I ever did when it came to that sort of thing. But I did enough to gain university entrance. Not that I went to university, but I got the necessary passes for that. Those were the old system of Scottish Highers and Lowers, changed since then. But as long as you had 3 Highers and 2 Lowers, that got you into university, and that's what I got.
And so what did you do after you left Robert Gordon?
I didn't go into the army straight away. My father wanted me to become, I don't know why, simply because he'd known one or two people who'd done rather well in the insurance world, and he wanted me to become an insurance underwriter. So I did that, but it became apparent to me before too long that that's not really what I wanted to do, and I went round to the recruiting office one day, unbeknown to him or anyone else, and joined up.
Did you actually join up on that day?
No, I had to. I went along, and the recruiting office, which was Gordon Hounder led, so it was an army recruiting office, was in Market Street in Aberdeen, and it was run by someone called Major George Slater, and he spoke to me, just a short 15-20 minutes, I suppose. Anyway, I was given the necessary forms, went home with them, and filled them in, submitted them, had another interview, and then the medical and all the rest. It didn't take too long, but that I didn't join up that day, but I went along that day. Probably took about a month, I suppose, from memory.
And at what point did you tell your parents that you were thinking of joining the army?
Well, the day I went home with the forms, I told them that I wanted to join, but that was all right. I mean, they knew I wasn't really devoted to a career in insurance. They thought joining the army was all right, and particularly joining the Gordon Hounders was all right.
Okay, so that was acceptable.
Oh, yeah.
So did you actually go back to this place to officially sign on, or what happened then?
Yes, I did. Filling in the form, I just was asked to hand it in the next day or the following day, which I did, and then an interview was set up, because we then had to discuss what I was going to join, and you know, they sort of guide you and so on. So even though I knew what I wanted to do, you know, you do have an interview, and I had that with George Slater, and then it was agreed that I would join the Gordon Hounders, and but you have to do your basic training first, and that was all explained, and then a day was set for a medical exam, which happened, and then you're sent off to your new unit.
Okay. And where about was your new unit?
Well, strangely enough, it wasn't up at Fort George, where a normal... Had I joined the Gordons at that moment, I'd have gone to do my square bashing basic training up at Fort George. But I was advised against that by George Slater, and it was good advice too, because he told me that if you join... if you're going to be commissioned into the Gordons, it's not necessarily a good thing to do your basic training there, because you meet, you know, just about everyone in your squad is not going to be commissioned. They're going to be jocks in the rank. And you become buddies with these people, and it's not necessarily a good thing to be a buddy one day and their platoon commander next. So he said, do something else, because basic training is basic training, and then you go to cadet college, and then you can go to the Gordons. So I joined the Intelligence Corps, who had a depot down in Maresfield in Sussex, which is a lovely place to spend a summer, and that's exactly what I did. So I had 16 very happy weeks doing my basic training in Sussex with the Intelligence Corps.
Okay, but was it the same basic training that you would have received anyway?
Identical, yeah. Wherever you went, no, whether you were joining a corps or an infantry unit or a tank regiment, basic training is basic training. It's just the usual things, drill, a lot of drill, learning how to put on your uniform, and just taking you away from civilian society and into an army one. But the basic training was the same.
Okay. And so you said that it was roughly about a month that, you know, before you actually signed up and that. What was the next step then? Did you get correspondence saying that you'd go somewhere at a certain date? Or?
Yes, I did. I got, it wouldn't be a posting order, I don't think, but I got written confirmation that I was to report to the Intelligence Corps depot in Maresfield on such and such a day. I got a train warrant to get me there, directions as to where it was, because I didn't know where it was, and what I was to take, just the normal package that would come to someone who's never been in the army before. And off I went with a suitcase, toothbrush, all the usual things, and arrived at the gates of Maresfield.
Can you remember your feelings as you were leaving Aberdeen that day to join the army?
Yes, yes, I can, yes. No, great excitement, I'm sure I remember that. A little bit of trepidation, I suppose, because, I really had, at school, never been in the cadet corps. I'd never really been in contact with the army. So arriving at the sort of barbed wire, Nissen-hutted, rather Spartan camp was something new to me, but excitement was the memory I keep.
Okay. And can you describe the camp for us as well, please?
Yes, I can. And it has to come from memory of sort of 45 years ago. But because I did go there two or three years ago, but it's not a camp anymore. It's a built-up part of the village. So I think I remember seeing one Nissen hut. It really was a very run down. It had been used during the war, so it was Nissen huts, just with, in the center of each hut was a stove which you were allowed to light in the evenings if necessary, and filled it with coke, and it was a disgusting thing. But it was very, very Spartan set up, just a series of these huts for people at various stages of their training. I suppose a squad of 30 we were, and that would meant we had four or five huts. There were other squads at different stages of training, so I suppose there were 15 or 20 huts and a few more for the officers, but it was a beaten up old barracks.
And can you remember the reception you got when you first went to, would it be the guard's house?
Yes, exactly. The guard room is where you're told to report, and they send you along to the administration office where you meet up with the depot sergeant major, who I suppose it was a form of greeting, but not as welcoming as it might have been. And, you're simply told that you're in squad so-and-so, and I can't remember which squad I was in, but it was the one that was forming the next day. People were arriving the whole of that day, and we were just told where we were living. A corporal took me across to it. That was where I was to bunk, pointed out where the naffy was, and where the cookhouse was. And we were just forming up that day, and then the next day would be day one of our basic training. So it was just a meeting up day.
And can you remember how many men were in the same Nissen hut as you?
Yes, I think we were eight. People from far-flung places, from England, Scotland, Wales, and an Irishman. And a wrestler, professional wrestler, was there, because it was the days of national service too, and he would start the day with about 50 or 60 press-ups, very fit man. So, yes, I think we were about eight.
And how did you feel being in this dormitory with these other seven people that you didn't know, and obviously from all different types of society?
Yeah, yes they were, and difficulty understanding one or two of them. I remember one chap from Staffordshire, it was very hard to understand, another fellow from Derbyshire also. There was a Cockney, there's always a Cockney in your squad, of course, and it was just terrific. I mean, you because you're all in at the deep end, as it were, you really do bond very quickly, and by the end of 16 weeks, you're great buddies, all of you, and particularly, of course, the ones in your hut, in your dormitory. But you become very friendly with them all. I mean, that's the whole thing about the army. I mean, now that I look back, you know, it was the friendship that you make and you forge. You really do have great friends in the army, and probably all because you're just chucked in, and you have to get on, and you do get on.
And did they know that you were going to be an officer?
Well, yes, they did, because what I went in was because I was older than the age of going to Sandhurst, because I'd done my insurance thing for nearly 3 years. I went in on what is known as an S-type engagement. I don't think it exists anymore. But that meant that you went in, you did your basic training, and then you were guaranteed a WOSB, as it was called, a WOSB, a War Office Selection Board, now called the Regular Commissions Board. Same thing. That was your interview, 3 or 4 days interview down at Westbury in Wiltshire, to see whether you were suitable for officer training. And so the arrangement was on this S-type engagement, you do your basic training, then you're guaranteed the interview process, and if you fail it, you're allowed to leave the army, and that's the end of it. And you haven't wasted much time, perhaps 6 months, whatever. You have the option and the opportunity too, if you like what you've done, what you've seen, to stay on and just, you know, join as a private soldier and so on. But anyway, I was guaranteed that. So I went in on an S-type engagement, and I was the only person there who was. The rest were just going to go straight on with a military career in the intelligence corps. And so they knew that, yeah.
And did they accept you okay?
Absolutely. Oh, yes, that made no difference at all. They readily accepted it. I suppose if there was any feeling at all, it might have come from one or two of the training NCOs who also, of course, knew that you were hoping to be commissioned, and they would, with great good humour, make you do some things twice instead of once. But no, there was no anti-feeling at all, anything but.
And can you tell me about the issue of your uniform, you know, when it was issued and what you felt about it?
Yes, well, I suppose the first thing we did on day one, which would have been the following day, was to go along to the QM and be kitted out, and that's a fairly formal process. And the dress in those days was, or the smart dress, the tunic, was battle dress, known as BD, which was a very thick jerkin type top, and the trousers, and a terribly hot, hairy outfit it was, and of course all your belts, and which all had to be blankoed and brassed and so on, and then you had your denim overalls for day-to-day stuff. So being kitted out was a bit of a process, and being shown how to wear these things, and most important of all, how to clean them, was very much a part of day one.
And can you remember exactly what they issued you with? You know, how many pairs of trousers?
It was certainly just one one battle dress set, which was trousers and top. And I think probably just one pair of denims, which was top and bottom. You then had your PE kit, which was a red T-shirt, a white T-shirt, and a pair of blue shorts, and the brown sand shoes, you would have called them. They were gym shoes, nothing smart as trainers, anything like that. your beret and your cap badge, then your gaiters, your boots, of course, and just one set of each of those and your belt. And I think that's all. It wasn't a huge amount. It was only, 16 weeks' worth, so to speak.
And can you remember being shown how to look after them as well?
Oh, yes, indeed. That all happened on day one, and from day two on, then you were meant to look pretty smart and look as though you've been a soldier for a very long time, I remember. Yes, but the training was so thorough, you were shown everything. You were really led by the hand, in a very firm sort of way, of course, but nothing was left for you to wonder about. You were shown everything was explained, and then you were meant to have remembered it.
Okay, and was it your responsibility to keep your kit clean, or was there like a washer lady somewhere?
No, absolutely not. No, it was for you. I mean, keeping clean, was the sort of belt and gaiter and boot bit. You certainly had to press everything yourself, but your laundry, there was a laundry, I mean your underwear, your socks, because you were issued a number of pairs of socks, your PT kit and so on. You were allowed, I think from memory, about 7 items a week to go off to the laundry, and they would go off one day, whichever laundry day it was, and come back about 3 days later. So there was a unit laundry, yes, that you could put the necessary washables away.
Okay, and how did you feel about doing these things for yourself?
Well, it was the first time I think I probably had to do them, and it didn't come as a shock. Nothing did. It all came very naturally. But the standards were very high, and perhaps higher than any civilians used to, and you realize that when you think you've cleaned your boots, you haven't cleaned your boots, or not to a satisfactory standard. So it comes as a bit of a shock, and the whole thing is a bit of a shock, but it's a short, sharp shock. 16 weeks isn't all that long, really. And by the end of those 16 weeks, I mean, it's as natural as could be to clean your kit to a high standard. Quite painless.
And what about equipment? When did you start to get equipment?
Well, I forgot that. That was part of the QM. On day one, you were issued with your rucksack, your front and rear pouches, your rifle sling. These were all part of the rifles, of course, you were issued with, but they were kept in the armory. But you had your particular rifle, which had to be cleaned the whole time. But all the marching equipment, battle equipment, was yours to keep in your cupboard and keep cleaned the whole time.
And so your rifle, were you even issued with that on your first day?
Probably not on day one. No, I think from memory we didn't have our first weapon training lesson probably for 3 or 4 weeks into the course. We didn't drill with a rifle initially. And we certainly didn't go to a rifle range, or even have weapon training lessons for probably 4 weeks. But as soon as that period was over, we were issued with our rifle, kept in the armory. But that is the rifle that you drilled with and cleaned, worked on during weapon training periods, and then used on the rifle range, live firing.
Can you remember the make of rifle it was?
Yes, it wasn't the 303 Enfield. No, we went right into the self-loading rifle. It had just arrived. It was a very new weapon to the army in those days. It was a 7.62 self-loading rifle, and I never had the 303 Enfield. That had just been phased out. So I do remember that.
And that was in 1961?
That was 1960 or 61, right? 61. That's absolutely right.
Okay. And you've described the accommodation. When you first saw it, what did you think?
Well, it was Spartan, to say the least. It was cold, and Yes, I think it was much more dilapidated than I had imagined. I had only seen barracks before that from the outside, driving past, and seen them in Edinburgh. Probably seen Gordon barracks of Bridget Dawn here, and they're all good stone buildings. This was so antiquated. It was only put up to last the period of the war, and it was still being used. Well, that was 15 years after that. It was dilapidated. Not a homely place at all, really.
And can you remember the food?
Yes, the food was not of a high quality. I remember being not disappointed, because you got enough, and that's the important thing, because you were always hungry, so whatever you got was eaten. But what was very noticeable to me in looking back was how quickly food became better in the army. And when I left, it was of the highest standard. I mean, the cooks were chefs, and the quality of the raw product was good, and the cooked product was excellent. In the old days, I mean, there'd always been jokes made about army food. Everything was beans, and it was, and they were watery beans. Mince was the order of the day, and it was always watery and chewy, and a lot of potatoes, I remember. But so it was poor quality, but we got enough. That was important, because you were always hungry.
And did it seem quite a change, you know, from what you maybe got at home, or you maybe got at school or something? Was it quite a change from that?
Yes, certainly, because it was so basic, really. If every table, I remember, in the cookhouse had Daddy's HP sauce, a big bottle was on the middle of every table, and if you didn't douse whatever you were eating with Daddy's sauce, you know. So I mean, it was 6 weeks, 16 weeks of Daddy's sauce with whatever was under it. Yes, awful food, really, nothing like home at all.
Do you ever try Daddy's sauce now?
I don't know if you get Daddy's sauce. I suppose the nearest thing you remember is HP sauce. No, but I haven't been searching for Daddy's sauce. It's only a memory, and that's the way to keep it, I think.
Can you remember the kit inspections?
The which section?
The kit inspection.
Oh, the kit inspection. Oh, yes. Yes, very clearly I can, because your kit was never clean enough, no matter what you've done or how long you've spent dealing with it. It wasn't up to standard, and you were then just given more time that evening to bring everything up to standard. There'd be another kit inspection the next day. Still wasn't up to standard, and so it would go on until finally they did decide to relent and accept that your kit was really not all that bad. But kit inspections were quite a thing. You would have a daily one by your squad corporal, training corporals. Would check her out every day. The platoon sergeant, squad sergeant, would certainly do it two or three times. Then your platoon commander would come on at least once a week. And then Friday was the company commander, a Major Cross, I remember his name was, whom I met only once after leaving the depot. But his inspection was an important one. So our kit was always being inspected, and no matter who's inspecting, it had to be up to standard.
Okay. Can you describe what you had to do for a daily kit inspection?
Well, certainly you had to spend all the evening, the day before, cleaning your kit. And you had to get up very early, because your kit inspection was part of the room inspection, and your bed inspection, and your locker inspection. So you had to get up at least an hour before normal reveille times, which would have been 6, so you had to be up at 5 just to start making your bed, which you'd been sleeping in, so you couldn't do that the night before. Cleaning out the stove, getting rid of the coke, which you could only do that morning. Bumping the floors, polishing them, because you could only do them that morning. your layout, your kit, which you've been able to do the night before, get your locker.